You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. All these translations are available through SteinerBooks.org or RudolfSteinerPress.com. Please consider patronizing those organizations. They provide the translations for Steiner that we get to hear here. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Harmony of the Creative Word, the Human Being, and the Elemental, Animal, Plant, and Mineral Kingdoms, formerly known as Man as Symphony of the Creative Word, Collected Works, Volume 230, 12 Lectures, revised translation by Matthew Barton. This is beginning of Part 3, entitled The Plant World and the Elemental Nature Spirits. This is Lecture 7. Given on the 2nd of November, 1923. To the outwardly perceptible, visible world, there belongs the invisible world, and these, taken together, form a whole. The marked degree to which this is the case first appears in its full clarity when we turn our attention away from the animals to the plants. Plant life, as it sprouts and springs forth from the earth, immediately arouses our delight, but it also provides access to something which we must feel to be full of mystery. In the case of the animal, though, certainly its will and whole inner activity have something of the mysterious. We nevertheless recognize that this will is actually there, and is the cause of the animal's form and outer characteristics. But in the case of the plants, which appear on the face of the earth in such magnificent variety of form, which develop in such a mysterious way out of the seed with the help of earth and the surrounding air. In the case of the plant, we feel that some other factor must be present in order that this plant world may arise in the form it does. When spiritual vision is directed to the plant world, we are immediately led to a whole host of beings which were known and recognized in the old times of instinctive clairvoyance, but which were afterward forgotten, and today remain only as names used by the poet, names to which modern man ascribes no reality. To the same degree, however, in which we deny reality to the beings that flit so busily around the plants, to that degree do we lose understanding of the plant world. This understanding of the plant world, which, for instance, would be so necessary for the practice of medicine, has been entirely lost to present-day humanity. We have already recognized a very significant connection between the world of plants and the world of butterflies, but this too will only really come alive for us when we look yet more deeply into the whole range of activities and processes that go on in the plant world. Plants send down their roots into the ground. Anyone who can observe what they really send down and can perceive the roots with spiritual vision, for this he must have, sees how the root is everywhere surrounded by the activities of elemental nature spirits. And these elemental spirits, which an old clairvoyant perception designated as gnomes, and which we may call the root spirits, can actually be studied through imagination and inspiration, just as human life and animal life can be studied in the physical world. We can look into the soul nature of these elemental spirits, into this world of the spirits of the roots. The root spirits are quite special earth folk, invisible at first to outer view, but in their effects so much the more visible. For no root could develop if it were not for what is mediated between the root and the earth realm by these remarkable root spirits, which bring the mineral element of the earth into flux in order to conduct it to the roots of plants. I am, of course, referring to the underlying spiritual process. These root spirits, which are everywhere present in the earth, get a quite particular sense of well-being from rocks and from ores, which may be more or less transparent and also contain metallic elements. They have the greatest feeling of well-being in this sphere, because it is the place where they belong, where they are conveying what is mineral to the roots of the plants. And they are filled with an inner spirituality that we can only compare to the inner spirituality of the human eye, EYE, and the human ear. For these root spirits are, in their spiritual nature, entirely sense. Apart from this, they are nothing at all. They consist only of sense. They are entirely sense. And it is a sense which is at the same time intellect, which does not only see and hear, but immediately understands what is seen and heard. It not only receives impressions, but everywhere also receives ideas. We can even indicate the way in which these root spirits receive their ideas. We see a plant sprouting out of the earth. The plant enters, as I shall presently show, into connection with the extraterrestrial universe. And particularly at certain seasons of the year, spiritual currents flow from above, from the flower and the fruit of the plant, down into the root, streaming into the earth. And just as we turn our eyes toward the light and see, so do the root spirits turn their faculty of perception toward what trickles downward from above, through the plant, into the earth. What trickles down toward the root spirits is something which the light has sent into the flowers, which the heat of the sun has sent into the plants, which the air has produced in the leaves, which the distant stars have brought about in creating the plant form. The plant gathers the secrets of the universe, sends them into the ground, and the gnomes take these secrets into themselves, from what trickles down spiritually to them through the plants. And because the gnomes, particularly from autumn on and through the winter, in their wanderings through ore and rock, bear with them what has trickled down to them through the plants, they are the beings within the earth which carry the ideas of the whole universe on their streaming, wandering journey through the earth. We look out into the wide world. The world has been built of the spirit of the universe. It embodies the ideas of the universe, of the spirit of the universe. Through the plants, which to them are the same as rays of light are to us, the gnomes take in the ideas of the universe and carry them in full consciousness from metal to metal, from rock to rock within the earth. We gaze down into the depths of the earth, not to seek there below for abstract ideas about some kind of mechanical laws of nature, but to behold the roving, wandering gnomes, which are the light-filled preservers of cosmic reason within the earth. These gnomes have immediate understanding of what they see. Their knowledge is of a similar nature to that of man, but they are the epitome of intellect. They are nothing but intellect. Everything about them is intellect. But an intellect so universal that they look down on human reason as something imperfect. The gnomes laugh us to scorn on account of the groping, struggling intellect with which we manage to grasp one thing or another, whereas they have no need at all to think things out. They have direct perception of what is sensible and intelligent in the world. And they are particularly ironical when they notice the efforts people have to make to come to this or that conclusion. Why should they do this? Say the gnomes. Why ever should people give themselves so much trouble to think things over? We know everything we look at. People are so stupid, say the gnomes, for they must first think things over. Gnomes can actually be ironical, to the point of ill manners if one speaks to them of logic. For why ever should people need such a superfluous thing, a training in thinking? The thoughts are already there. The ideas flow through the plants. Why don't people stick their noses into the earth, down to the depth of the plant's roots, and let what the sun says to the plants trickle down into their noses? Then they would know something. But with logic, say the gnomes, one can only have odd bits and pieces of knowledge. Thus the gnomes are actually the bearers of the ideas of the universe, of the cosmos, inside the earth. But for the earth itself, they have no liking at all. They flit about in the earth with cosmic ideas, but they actually hate what is earthly. This is something from which the gnomes would best like to escape. Nevertheless, they remain with the earthly. You will soon see why this is so, but they hate it, for the earthly threatens them with continual danger. The earth continually holds over them the threat of forcing them to take on particular shapes. The configuration of the creatures I described to you in the last lecture, the amphibians, and in particular of frogs and toads. The feeling of the gnomes within the earth is really this. If we grow too strongly together with the earth, we shall assume the form of frogs or toads. They are continually on the alert to avoid being caught up too strongly in the earth and be forced to take on such an earthly form. They are always on the defensive against this earthly form, which threatens them in the element in which they exist, as I have described. They have their home in the element of earth and moisture. There they live under the constant threat of being forced into amphibian forms. From this they continually tear themselves free by filling themselves entirely with ideas of the extraterrestrial universe. The gnomes are really the element within the earth which represents the extraterrestrial, because they must continually avoid growing together with the earthly. Otherwise, they would individually take on the forms of the amphibian world. And it is just from what I may call this feeling of hatred, this feeling of antipathy toward the earthly, that the gnomes gain the power of driving the plants up from the earth. With the fundamental force of their being, they unceasingly thrust away from the earthly. And it is this thrust that determines the upward direction of plant growth. They impel the plants along with them. The antipathy that the gnomes have to anything earthly causes the plant to have only its roots in the earth and then grow out of the earth. In fact, the gnomes force the plants out of their true original form and make them grow upward and out of the earth. Once the plant has grown upward, once it has left the domain of the gnomes and has passed out of the sphere of the element of moist earth into the sphere of moist air, the plant develops what comes to outer physical form in the leaves. Other beings are at work now in everything that goes on in the leaves, water spirits, elemental spirits of the watery element, to which an earlier instinctive clairvoyance gave the name of undines, among others. Just as we found gnome beings flitting busily around the roots, we see close to the soil these water beings, these elemental beings of the water, these undines, who observe with pleasure the upward striving growth that the gnomes have produced. These undine beings differ in their outer nature from gnomes. They cannot turn outward toward the universe like a spiritual sense organ. They can only yield themselves up to the movement and activity of the whole cosmos in the element of air and moisture, and they therefore do not have the clarity of mind that the gnomes have. They dream incessantly, these undines, but their dream is at the same time their own form. They do not hate the earth as intensely as do the gnomes, but they have a sensitivity to what is earthly. They live in the etheric element of water, swimming and floating in it. they are highly sensitive to anything in the nature of a fish, for the fish's form is a threat to them. They do assume it from time to time, though only to forsake it immediately in order to take on another metamorphosis. They dream their own existence. And in dreaming their own existence, they bind and release. They bind and separate the substances of the air, which in a mysterious way they introduce into the leaves. They take these substances to the plants that the gnomes have thrust upward. The plants would wither at this point if it were not for the undines, who approach from all sides. And as they move around the plants in their dreamlike consciousness, they prove to be what we can only call world chemists. The undines dream the binding and releasing of substances. And this dream through which the plant exists, into which it grows when developing upward, it leaves the ground. This undine dream is the world chemist inducing the mysterious combining and separation of substances in the plant world, starting in the leaf. We can therefore say that the undines are the chemists of plant life. They dream of chemistry. They possess an exceptionally delicate spirituality, which is really in its element just where water and air come into contact with each other. The undines live entirely in the element of moisture, but they feel their own inner satisfaction when they come to the surface of something watery, be it only a drop of water or something else of a watery nature. For their whole endeavor lies in preserving themselves from totally assuming the form of a fish, the permanent form of a fish. They wish to remain in a state of metamorphosis, in a state of eternal, endlessly continuing changeability. But in this state of changeability, in which they dream of the stars and of the sun, of light and of heat, they become the chemists, who now, starting from the leaf, continue with the further development of the plant form that has been thrust upward by the gnomes. So the plant develops its leaf growth, and this mystery is now revealed as the dream of the undines into which the plants grow. To the same degree, however, in which the plant grows into the dream of the undines, it now enters into another domain higher up, into the domain of the spirits which live in the element of air and warmth. Just as the gnomes live in that of earth and moisture, and the undines in the element of air and moisture, in the element of air and warmth live the beings which an earlier clairvoyant faculty called the sylphs. Because air is everywhere imbued with light, these sylphs, living in the element of air and warmth, press toward the light and become related to it. They are particularly susceptible to more delicate, but more widespread movements within the atmosphere. When in spring or autumn you see a flock of swallows, which produce vibrations in a body of air as they fly along, creating a current of air, this moving air current, and this holds good for every bird, is something the sylphs can hear. Cosmic music is what they hear from it. If, let us say, you are traveling somewhere by ship and the seagulls are flying toward it, their flight sets in motion spiritual sounds, a spiritual music that accompanies the ship. Again, it is the sylphs which unfold and develop their being within this sounding music, finding themselves at home in the moving current of air. It is in this spiritually sounding, moving element of air that they find themselves at home. And at the same time, they absorb what the power of light sends into these vibrations of the air. Because of this, the sylphs, which experience existence more or less in a state of sleep, feel most in their element, most at home, where birds are winging through the air. If a sylph is obliged to flit through air devoid of birds, it feels as though it had lost itself. but at the sight of a bird in the air, something quite special comes over the sylph. I have often had to describe a certain event in human life, the event which leads the human soul to address itself as I, capital. And I have always drawn attention to the statement made by Jean-Paul, that when a human being first arrives at the conception of his I, it is as though he looks into the most deeply veiled holy of holies of his soul. A sylph does not look into any such veiled holy of holies of its own soul, but when it sees a bird, a feeling of ego comes over it. The sylph feels its ego through what the bird sets in motion as it flies through the air. And because this is so, because its ego is kindled in it from outside, the sylph becomes the bearer of cosmic love through the atmosphere. It is because the sylph embodies something like a human wish, but does not have its ego within itself, but in the bird kingdom, that it is at the same time the bearer of wishes of love through the universe. Thus we behold the deepest sympathy between the sylphs and the bird world. The gnome hates the amphibian world, the undine is sensitive to fishes, is unwilling to approach them, seeks to avoid them, and feels a kind of horror for them. The sylph, on the other hand, is attracted toward birds, and has a sense of well-being when it can waft toward their feathered flight the floating air filled with sound. And were you to ask a bird from whom it learns to sing, you would hear that its inspirer is the sylph. Sylphs feel a sense of pleasure in the bird's form. They are, however, prevented by the cosmic order from becoming birds, for they have another task. Their task is lovingly to convey light to the plant. And just as the undine is the chemist for the plant, so is the sylph the light bearer. The sylph imbues the plant with light. It bears light into the plant. Through the fact that the sylphs bear light into the plant, something quite remarkable is brought about. You see, the sylph is continually carrying light into the plant. The light, that is to say, the power of the sylphs in the plant, works on the chemical forces that were induced in the plant by the undines. Here occurs the interworking of the sylph's light and the undine's chemistry. This is a remarkable molding and shaping activity. With the help of the upstreaming substances which are worked on by the undines, the sylphs weave an ideal plant form out of the light. They actually weave the archetypal plant within the plant from light and from the chemical working of the undines. And when, toward autumn, the plant withers, and everything of physical substance disperses, then these forms of the plants begin to trickle downward. And now the gnomes perceive them, perceive what the world, the sun through the sylphs, the air through the undines, has brought to pass in the plant. This the gnomes perceive. And throughout the entire winter they are engaged in perceiving below what has trickled down into the soil from the plants. Down there they grasp world ideas in the plant forms which have been given shape and form with the help of the sylphs, and which now enter into the soil in their spiritual ideal form. People who regard the plant as something material will, of course, know nothing of this spiritual ideal form. Thus, at this point, a colossal error, a terrible error, appears in materialistic observation of the plant. I'll give you a brief outline of this. Everywhere you will find that in materialistic science, matters are described as follows. The plant takes root in the ground. Above the ground, it develops its leaves, and finally its flowers, and within the flowers the stamens, then the carpel. The pollen from the anthers, usually from another plant, is taken over to the stigma, the carpel is fertilized, and through this the seed of the new plant is produced. That is the usual way of describing it. Footnote: a structure at the heart of the flower, consisting of the ovary containing the ovules and the style bearing the stigma, this is all what a carpel is, in botanical works usually referred to as the, quote, female reproductive organ of flowering plants, close quote, translator, and that's the carpel, end of footnote. The carpel is regarded as the female element, and what comes from the stamens as the male. Indeed, matters cannot be regarded otherwise, as long as people remain bound to materialism. For then this process really does look like fertilization. This, however, it is not. In order to gain insight into the process of fertilization, that is to say, the process of reproduction in the plant world, we must be conscious that in the first place the plant form arises through the work of those great chemists, the undines, and the work of the sylphs. This is the ideal plant form, which goes down into the ground and is kept safely by the gnomes. It is there, below this plant form. And there, within the earth, it is now guarded by the gnomes after they have seen and perceived it. The earth becomes the womb for what thus trickles downward. This is something quite different from what is described in materialistic science. Up here, and there's a drawing, after it has passed through the sphere of the sylphs, the plant enters the sphere of elemental fire spirits. These inhabit the element of heat and light. When the warmth of the earth is at its height, or has reached a sufficient level, it is gathered up by the fire spirits. Just as the sylphs gather up the light, so do the fire spirits gather up the warmth and carry it into the flowers of the plant. Undines carry the action of chemical ether into the plants, sylphs the action of light ether into the flowers, and the pollen provides what may be called little airships that enable the fire spirits to carry warmth into the seed. Everywhere warmth is collected with the help of the stamens, and is carried by means of the pollen from the anthers to the seeds and the carpel. And what is formed here, in the carpel, in its entirety, is the male element that comes from the cosmos. It is not a case of the carpel being female, and the anthers of the stamens being male. In no way does fertilization occur in the flower, but only the pre-forming of the male seed. Fertilization occurs when the cosmic male seed, which fire spirits in the flower take from the warmth of the universe, is brought together with the female principle that has trickled down into the soil as an ideal element at an earlier stage, as I have described, and is resting there. For plants, the earth is the mother, the heavens the father. And all that takes place outside the domain of the earth is not the maternal womb for the plant. It is a colossal error to believe that the maternal principle of the plant is in the carpel. This is, in fact, the male principle, which has been drawn forth from the universe with the aid of the fire spirits. The maternal element is taken from the cambium of the plant, which lies between bark and wood, and carried down as ideal form. And what now results from the combined gnomes and fire spirits' activity, this is fertilization. The gnomes are, in fact, the spiritual midwives of plant reproduction. Fertilization takes place below in the earth during the winter, when the seed enters the earth and meets with the forms which the gnomes have received from the activities of the sylphs and undines, and which they now carry to where these forms can meet with the fertilizing seeds. You see, because people do not recognize what is spiritual, Do not know that gnomes, undines, sylphs, and fire spirits, which were formerly called salamanders, are actively involved in plant growth? There is a complete lack of clarity about the process of fertilization in the plant world. Up there, outside the earth, nothing by way of fertilization takes place. The earth is the mother of the plant world, the heavens the father. This is the case in a quite literal sense. Plant fertilization takes place through the fact that gnomes take from fire spirits what the fire spirits have carried into the carpal as concentrated cosmic warmth on the tiny airships of the anther pollen. Thus the fire spirits are the bearers of warmth. And now you will easily gain insight into the whole process of plant growth. First, with the help of what comes from the fire spirits, the gnomes down below instill life into the plant and push it upward. They are the fosterers of life. They carry the life ether to the root, the same life ether in which they themselves live. The undines foster the chemical ether in the plant, the sylphs the light ether, the fire spirits the warmth ether. And then the fruit of the warmth ether again unites with what is present below as life. Thus plants can only be understood when they are considered in connection with all that is flitting around them, full of life and activity. And one only reaches the right interpretation of the most important process in the plant when one penetrates into these things in a spiritual way. When once this has been understood, it is interesting to look again at the words Goethe jotted down when responding to another botanist. He was terribly annoyed because people talked about endless marriages going on in the plants. Goethe was affronted by the idea that constant marriages were being consummated all over every meadow. This seemed to him something unnatural. In this, Goethe had an instinctive but very true feeling. He could not as yet know the real facts of the matter, but nevertheless his instinct was a sure one. He could not see why fertilization should take place up there in the flower. He did not as yet know what goes on below ground, and that the earth is the maternal womb of the plants. But he instinctively knew that the process which takes place in the flower is not what all botanists take it to be. You are now aware of the inner connection between plant and earth, but here is something else which you must take into account. You see, when up above the fire spirits are flitting around the plant and transmitting the pollen from the anthers, they have only one feeling, which compared to the feeling of the sylphs, they have in an enhanced degree. The sylphs experience their self, their ego, when they see the birds flit about. The fire spirits have this experience, but to an intensified degree, in regard to the butterfly world, and indeed the insect world as a whole. And it is these fire spirits which take the utmost delight in following the tracks of the insect's flight, so that they convey warmth to the carpal. In order to carry the concentrated warmth, which must descend into the earth so that it may be united with the plant's ideal form, the fire spirits feel themselves intimately related to the butterfly world and to the world of the insects in general. Everywhere they follow in the tracks of the insects as they flit from flower to flower. And so one really has the feeling, when following the flight of insects, that each of these insects, as it flits from flower to flower, has a quite special aura, which cannot be entirely explained from the insect itself. Particularly the luminous, wonderfully radiant, shimmering aura of bees as they flit from flower to flower is unusually difficult to explain. And why? It is because the bee is everywhere accompanied by a fire spirit, which feels so closely related to it that for spiritual vision, the bee is surrounded by an aura which is actually a fire spirit. When a bee flies through the air from plant to plant, from tree to tree, it flies with an aura that is actually given to it by a fire spirit. The fire spirit does not only gain a feeling of its ego in the presence of the insect, but it wishes to be completely united with the insect. Through this, insects also obtain that power about which I have spoken to you, which even shows itself in a shimmering forth of light into the cosmos. They obtain the power completely to spiritualize the physical matter which unites itself with them, and to allow this spiritualized physical substance to ray out into cosmic space. But just as heat is what first causes light to shine, so, above the surface of the earth, when the insects bring about this shimmering forth into cosmic space, which attracts the human being to descend again into physical incarnation, it is the fire spirits which inspire the insects to this activity. The fire spirits that flit around them. But if the fire spirits are active in promoting the outstreaming of spiritualized matter into the cosmos, they are no less actively engaged in seeing to it that the concentrated fiery element, the concentrated warmth, goes into the interior of the earth, so that with the help of the gnomes, the spirit form, which sylphs and undines cause to trickle down into the earth, may be awakened. This, you see, is the spiritual process of plant growth. And it is because the subconscious in man divines something of a special nature in the flowering, sprouting plant that he experiences the being of the plant as full of mystery. This is not to dismantle the mystery, of course, nor brush the dust from the butterfly's wings. Our instinctive delight in the plant is raised to a higher level when not only the physical plant is seen, but also that wonderful working of the gnome's world below, with its immediate understanding that gives rise to intelligence, the gnome's world, which first pushes the plant upward. Just as the human intellect is not subject to gravity, but the head is carried without us feeling its weight, so the gnomes, with the light of their intellect, overcome what is of the earth and push the plant upward. They prepare life down below, but the life would die away were it not given impetus by the chemical activity brought to it by the undines, and this must be imbued with light. And so we picture from below upward, in bluish, blackish shades, the force of gravity, to which an upward impulse is given by the gnomes, and flitting all around the plant, indicated by the leaves, the undine power that blends and disperses substances as the plant grows upward. From above downward, from the sylphs, light is made to leave its imprint in the plant and molds and creates the form which descends as an ideal form and is taken up by the maternal womb of the earth. Moreover, fire spirits flit around the plant and concentrate cosmic warmth in the tiny seed points. This is sent down to the gnomes together with the seed power, so that down there they can cause the plants to arise out of fire and life. And further, we now see that essentially the earth is indebted for its power of repulse and impulse for growth, and its density, to the antipathy of the gnomes and undines toward amphibians and fishes. If the earth is dense, this density is due to the antipathy by means of which the gnomes and undines maintain their form. When light and warmth come down to earth, this is at the same time an expression of that power of sympathy, that sustaining power of self-love, which is carried through the air, and to the sustaining sacrificial power of the fire spirits, which brings the power to descend to what is below. So, We may say that over the face of the earth, earth density, earth magnetism, and earth gravity, in their upwardly striving aspect, unite with the downward striving power of love and sacrifice. And in this interworking of the downward streaming force of love and sacrifice, and the upward streaming force of density, gravity, and magnetism, in this interworking, where the two streams meet, plant life develops on the surface of the earth. Plant life is an outer expression of the interworking of world love, world sacrifice, world gravity, and world magnetism. So, now, you have seen what matters when we direct our gaze to the plant world, which so enchants, uplifts, and inspires us. Real insight can only be gained when our vision embraces the spiritual, the supersensible, as well as what is accessible to the physical senses. This enables us to correct the capital error of materialistic botany, that fertilization occurs above the earth. What occurs there is not the process of fertilization, but the preparation of the plant's heaven-born male seed for the future plant, being nurtured in the maternal womb of the earth. The end of Lecture 7.